everybody, it's Robert.
And Kyle.
And we're sitting here at Pearl and Pine Brewery, and we appreciate these guys allowing us to be here. And we're sitting with our guest, Ethan. How you doing, Ethan?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
You're from Georgia. This is where you're from, and we're sitting right now in Senoia, Georgia, and you actually grew up, like, I don't know, 10 minutes down the road or something.
Yeah, I did.
For a better part.
Yep.
So, but your dad was in the Army.
That's right. So, I grew up in Georgia pretty much all over the place, from Atlanta, McKaysville, Georgia. I moved here locally in the seventh grade in Coweta County. My dad is prior 175, so I grew up hearing the stories about regiment and you know, all the cool things about it. You know, they always leave out the other stuff.
Yeah.
So I grew up, you know, pretty much idolizing the 75th Ranger Regiment, always something I wanted to pursue, and it really took me down that path, which was really awesome.
So this was post-Vietnam era then for your dad when he was in?
And that's right. I believe he served under, I may be incorrect, it was Lieutenant Colonel Stringham. He was his RTO.
Okay. So what year was he?
I believe it was the late 70s.
Okay.
I don't know the exact years, so.
Did you already know that you wanted to go into the Army, or was it something because of your dad, or was it, did you go check them all out? What happened?
So, you know, after high school, to be very honest, man, I was being an idiot. Like, straight up, just an idiot. And there came a time that I had met my wife. My buddies hit me up, and they're like, hey, dude, I'm going to this cabin with my girlfriend and some of her sorority sisters. He's like, do you want to come? And I was like, absolutely. I will be there.
Yeah.
So I met my wife at this, and she pretty much just, like, turned around my life, right? So I was like, I need to get my stuff straight. And finally, I was like, I just need to pull the trigger, go into the military. And fortunately enough, when I went to the recruiter and I did my testing, I was able to secure an Option 40 contract. Went straight basic airborne school, pre-RASP, with some amazing people. I mean, I cannot speak highly enough about the people in that organization. Then through RASP, and then I got assigned to 175.
And did you pick that, or how ironic is that that you ended up getting?
I actually...
So usually they do the eeny, miny, moe. That's why, you know.
We had just... I don't think we had graduated yet, but we had gotten our berets and we were like shaping them. And we're sitting in this room, a bunch of tables. And I think his name was Sergeant Hollingsworth, was at the front of the room. And he goes, I've got X amount of slots for 375. Who wants them? And the room just kind of, you know,
quiet.
Everybody kind of has an idea of where they want to go. At least in my opinion, not so many people want to go to 375 because it's at the flagpole. But I was one of those people. And I jumped up, ran to the front, and I didn't get it. And the reason why I wanted to go to 375, it was just, you know, it's closer to home.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to move away from my wife. She wasn't my wife at the time. But fortunately, I got assigned to 175. Nothing against 375. Amazing people. I was just very fortunate to where I got to go. And the people that I got to essentially bring me up and not make me a dumbass anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we were very fortunate.
Yeah. So 375. No, you're right. I have not met very many people who actually volunteer for 375. It was one of those things. It was a eeny, meeny, miny, moe type of thing, and they all got selected for 375.
Yep.
It wasn't something they – or they ended up being like mortar or something, and they, that time frame, they end up going to that. So you just said you went through OSA, and then you end up going to pre-RASP and RASP. Mm-hmm. And Andrew, did you go through the program with airborne school prior to pre-RASP?
I did.
Okay.
And from what I've heard, they've changed that up.
Yeah,
a lot of dudes would go to airborne school and then drop – in pre-RASP because they would just want that airborne slot. But when I went through, you did airborne school, the cadre for pre-RASP would pick you up at airborne school, you get scuffed up a little bit on the bus because no one knows the Ranger Creed yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to pre-RASP and they tune you up and get you ready for RASP.
Yeah.
So it's a really awesome experience.
Now you went in a time frame where there were some pretty heavy names that came out of 175 as well.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a chance to serve with any of the guys? Like, you know, I think Mike came from there, Mike Burke. You know, I think Brett Johnson also came from 175, the regimental sergeant major now.
Yep.
And he dropped a lot of big names as well, if
sure.
you go back and listen to that episode. So did you get a chance to serve with any of those legends?
I did. The biggest impact for me was my direct leadership.
Yeah.
So my team leaders and my squad leaders, they impacted my life even to now. I still keep in touch with them. When I think about doing something, I always think about what they would do. Guys like Jeff Slater, Eric Schaefer, guys like that, they directly impacted my life.
Yeah.
Really, really cool dudes.
Yeah. I think that was one of the things that now – probably more so than ever, I've heard a lot of people talk about the people over the last, say, 20, 25 years that have really made a major impact. And I think that's primarily because of the 20-year war and the importance of what that took in training and making sure other soldiers are prepared for what they're getting ready to go into and such. And so to me, it kind of makes me remember of the time period of post-Vietnam. So when you have those eras of individuals who stick around and decide to coach, mentor the young people, you guys reap the benefits of it.
We really do. And like the great thing, and this is just my opinion, while I was there, it can be a very intense lifestyle. However, they maintain a standard at every single level. And it's something that I took with me after regiment into my businesses, into my personal life. And they really, really do. Like, they look after their dudes, whether it seems harsh or not. They look after you, they treat you well, and they set you up for success on the civilian side. Once again, I cannot speak highly enough about the dudes I encountered there.
That's one thing I was really impressed with when we got the chance to go to regiment and talk to Sergeant Major Johnson, was just the professionalism around everywhere.
Sure.
Right? Whether it's that motor sergeant, I forget his name, but that kid was... Yeah,
the E5.
The E5 sergeant, motor sergeant that ran him. Yeah. Yeah, it was just excellence at every level. Mm-hmm. Was that intimidating getting there? And how did you handle that as a new private getting to a battalion?
Well, dude, so like you graduate RASP, you get your beret, you get your scroll, and honestly, you kind of think you're like, you're it. Mm-hmm. Like, I made it, and dude, that's not it. Like, that is the beginning. Like, yeah. you've met the standard. Now you're going to where you have to maintain the standard. Showing up at 175, it was interesting to start out, kind of funny. You know, they took us up into the headquarters building, and you have your higher up NCOs that come in, and they're asking you questions to determine what company you're going to go to. Everything from who went to college, who's married, what's your favorite baseball team, things like that. And then, you know, they'd ask, what's your favorite baseball team? If you got a good answer, they're like, I'll take this guy. But then you go into our COF, and it is literally this is just my opinion, the most deadly, aggressive frat house that you can possibly imagine walking into. And these dudes are monsters of, you know, amazing human beings, but it's extremely intimidating. But it's also a wonderful environment to grow up in, and they foster such a amazing, aggressive, but professional environment at all times. So interesting, but it creates a person that comes out of there that is set up for success at really any level, whether it's, you know, civilian level, whether you want to continue into a different profession within the military. They do a wonderful job.
Did your dad give you any advice or anything? I'm just curious. Like, it was a definitely different period. I mean, we're talking a span of 20 plus years, 30, you know, almost 30 years or so. So what was his words of wisdom that he gave you?
Don't quit.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, my dad is an amazing man. He's very quiet. He keeps himself extremely professional. He left out all the hard parts, but you know, when you look back, you don't really necessarily remember those parts. You always remember the good times with your buddies, the camaraderie that you had. And a lot of times that's what most people miss when they get out. It's not the bad times. It's all your buddies and the relationships that you build, whether it's professional or through friendships. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what, at least in my opinion, a lot of dudes struggle with when they come out, and that's what they're searching for out here. Yeah. You know, back then they wore, you know, like the super, super high-end tights, you know, like their boots were shined. I'm pretty sure they like starched their uniforms.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, when I got there, you know, one of the things with my squad leader, Slater, was this dude had the longest hair you can imagine. Like, he pushed it to the limits. His sideburns were like right at the edge. And he kind of expected that from you as well. Not to say he, you know, pushed past the standard. He just met it like right there.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of that had to do with GWAT and people not worried about those standards as much as 670-1 kind of kind of went away for a little bit. Not to say it did, but I mean, once we were in ACUs, you could realize no one really cared about how you look. The Army didn't care because they gave us ACUs. We didn't match anything.
Well, yeah. I mean, let's face it. When war is going on, you're important. Where you put your importance and priorities and stuff is going to be very different back then. What they wanted to make sure you were disciplined in a very different way so that you would be disciplined when it mattered.
Sure.
But they just trained you guys differently.
I had the long hair, too, like and all that. It's just – It's something about the airborne community.
Yeah.
Like it's very airborne to have the long hair, the beret that is not parallel to the marching surface.
It's like
you
slanted,
have the horn,
yeah,
or the eye covering. You got your one eye hanging out.
We definitely would push it sometimes.
Oh yeah.
You know, looking back at some of the photos, like you know, go see your buddy graduate Ranger School, and then you're looking at your beret. You're like, dang, like how did nobody call me out for that?
Yeah.
You know, but I guess you know, like you kind of got away with a little bit of stuff. You never. Outside of battalion, you know, you walk around within the company areas, like you're sharp. Like, you know, like if you're messed up at all, some dude 200 yards away is going to scream at you. They're going to take off running and they're going to fix you on the spot. But, you know, you get out there around the big Army, you know, you may get away with a little bit more.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Much, much different. So how many times did you end up deploying with?
Twice.
Them? Okay.
Yep. So two combat deployments. We did Korea and a couple other places for training.
Mm. Yeah. So on the deployments and what rank were you in those periods?
So my first deployment, I was fresh out of RASP.
Oh, wow.
I'm talking about, I showed up at the unit. My very first team leader was, his name was Salgado Benjamin. He is the biggest black dude I had ever seen in my life. And he scared the shit out of me. And one of the first questions he asked me, he took me into a cage in the cough and he's doing my initial counseling paperwork. And he like straight up looks at me. He's like, you ever killed anybody? And I'm like, oh my God, dude. Like, but where am I? Like, I just entered this whole new realm within my life. You know, obviously I'm like, you know, no sergeant. I'm like locked up. He turned out to be once again, this amazing human being that I actually ran into him in Savannah not long ago. But I got to the unit, I got issued my equipment. I remember some dudes were kind of ticked off at me because this is right when ops corps were coming into circulation and I got an ops corps from the issue facility and there were like tabs and team leaders that didn't have them yet. And so obviously when we got over there,
somebody stole it.
They were stealing it.
Yeah.
Cause they didn't, I didn't get to go out on target yet.
Yeah.
So they trained me up, got to go out on target. Dude, I've got a really silly story for my first deployment. So my, and I'm probably going to shoot myself in the foot. I'm probably going to make fun of online about this.
Yeah, that's all right. Go ahead.
So my first time out, we hit this objective and we're going to Expo. We're in PZ posture in this field. And the birds come to land, right? And like first time, I'm carrying a ladder. I got a litter on my back. Like I'm just kind of sucking, right?
Yeah.
It was so bad. I was so cherry that like I couldn't figure out why I couldn't see. And I didn't realize that my eye pro were fogged up and not my nods. So I'm wiping my nods and it was my eye pro, right? So I can't see. There's this brown out and I'm falling everywhere. And dudes are like trying to pick me up. We loaded ladders on the bird first and I trip on the ledge of the 47, right? And as I'm going up and I'm stumbling, I fall sideways and I get a ladder stuck horizontally on the 47.
Oh no.
And it is completely stuck. Myself, Benjamin, once he's this jack dude, we're trying to yank it out. I'm on the opposite side of it and I'm watching the entire platoon on their hands and knees crawling up under it, onto this bird with the detainees and everything. And I'm just this brand new private, just got to the unit and I'm just sitting on the other side and I'm like, man, I'm done. Like, this is it. Lifelong dream done. First time out, it's over. We land, we were in Bastion. And
so they closed the ramp. They were able to close the ramp at least.
I think the ramp stayed open for the whole flight.
Okay.
And get back to Bastion, we land. My first platoon sergeant was Sergeant King, Sergeant First Class King. And he stands up, the lights come on. This dude just rips this freaking ladder out. Like, it didn't look like he, like, even tried. And there were two of us before. Yanks it out, and he's like, this is not acceptable. And he drops it. And I was just like, oh, my God. Like, cannot believe that just happened. Unfortunately, like I thought that was it for me, right? So we go do our debrief, whatever. And me and Ben are sitting in this bunker, and it's daylight now. Ben comes up to me, and he actually takes it on the chin. He doesn't get on to me at all. He goes, Gamble, that was my fault. He's like, I shouldn't have had you do that. Like, that was on me. And that was super impressive, being such a young dude coming into this organization. Like, me personally, still to this day, it's my fault. But him as a leader and a mentor, like, he stepped up. He identified the problem.
Yeah.
And he recognized, like, hey, man, like, I'm your first line leader. That was my fault. That's not you.
So that early sign of, like, servant leadership right yes. there, that's a great example for yeah. a young soldier just.
Yeah.
Like, he knew that you were jacked up. You could have you could have known your equipment better.
Yes.
But he could have known you didn't know your equipment as good as you needed to.
Yeah. So, like, when we would train up for it, right? So my TABS, once again, awesome dudes. Like, TABS, they're amazing. Like, they're the fire breathers, but they're freaking awesome. We would train, like, you know, putting the ladders together, like, it's dark, everything like that, like, putting them up on the wall, like, doing all that type of stuff. And there wasn't necessarily, in my opinion, a way to train, like, a brownout if you had never done it through, like, a training cycle.
Yeah.
Like, I was fresh. So everything had been trained up. Everything went well. And then just that one thing, like, I just dropped the ball hard.
So when you were coming in, I mean, you were holding it. You didn't know.
I had it over my shoulder.
Ah.
So, like, essentially, I stepped my arm through it. I was holding part of it.
Yeah.
We didn't take it apart. So when we infilled, they were apart. And then we would connect them before we go up on a wall. When we exfilled, we didn't take it apart. So I had this full ladder. And then I hit the lip of it, and I'm stumbling and just mm-hmm. turned sideways and lodged.
You caught one end and the other end shoved in.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So.
Yeah, but that was a great opportunity for you to see not only that you've got a good NCO that's willing to take care mm-hmm. of you and such, but that you're in a good unit.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, that's... You mentioned earlier about never quit. That's mm-hmm. a message that's always put out there. And as much as people say it, especially for you who are listening that or are watching this, that the better rate are those people who actually, in terms of percentages of making RASP, are those individuals who go to basic training or OSIT, excel, and get an opportunity to apply for RASP and then go through pre-RASP and RASP, then they are those who go through option 40. And it's primarily because they get all these, you know, they watch the videos, they see all the cool stuff and everything. And then when reality starts hitting, they realize that, you know, maybe that's not what they want. And for whatever reason, they quit and they never make it through. But if you go in with the mindset of never quitting and just going all the way to the end and make them select you out.
Mm-hmm. Don't self-select.
Don't self-select.
That's something we've heard for the last year yeah. and a half from most of our guests is don't self-select.
One of the things my dad always told me too is like, they can't eat you, son.
No.
Like there's only so much they can do to you. And another thing is like, we tend to make things a lot harder in our heads than they actually are, right? So I remember at we just gone from pre-RASP to RASP. We're sitting on these like pebble stone rocks, right? And you can hear when people move. I had this, I can't remember his name, but he was a Native American, Sergeant Thunderhawk. He was our NCOIC for RASP. He came out and there was First Sergeant Phipps, I believe it was. And he was a Somalia Ranger. Came out and they were talking to us and said, everybody put your heads down, close your eyes. He's like, this is gonna get hard. You know, if you want to quit, now's the time. Hadn't even started yet. We hadn't done a push-up, nothing, but everybody's in their heads. The second he said that, you hear pebbles moving. Dudes are already quitting. And I say that just because, like, for a dude that's listening to go to RASP, like, yes, it's difficult, you know, at every level, but you tend to make things harder in your mind than what they are. And that's at every level, outside of the military as well. Whether it's a civilian profession, you go to interview for a boss, you know, no one can eat you. You know, it's all in your head. And as long as you don't quit, you have the right mindset, you're obviously physically fit and you're prepared, then you can go out there and you can crush it.
But it doesn't end there. Just like you were talking about earlier, I mean, once you get into the unit, you got to earn that beret every day, that scroll every week.
That's right. Yeah. And that's such an amazing thing about that organization is it's not like I pass the test, I'm in forever. It's no, you're tested every single day at every single level, not just professionally, but personally, you know, like, are you a good person outside of work? Do you treat your wife and your children with love and affection? You know, are you a good person? And you have to maintain that standard while you're there, or else they're real quick to get rid of dudes. And I think one of the most, in my opinion, one of the more embarrassing things to see when I was there is a dude that's getting RFS'd because you lose that beret and you walk around the company area in a PC instead of a beret. And you know, like, hey, that dude fucked up. He did something wrong. Why is he out? So that's always one of those things I would look at and be like, don't ever be that guy.
Right.
But it is an amazing place for, you know, if there's someone listening right now that's considering it, I highly recommend it. Like, it will set you up for longevity throughout life.
Well, and you gave that story from the deployment, and I wanted to kind of bring it full circle in the fact that once you get in, you're working with consummate professionals. I mean, these people, sure, they want to hold you still. They want to let you know that you messed up.
Yep.
While at the same token, somebody else comes that's your direct supervisor and says, I got you. You know, I'm the one that messed up. We're going to take care of this, you know, because they recognize you're a good soldier. Mm-hmm. And they're going to try and teach you and make you better. And so I think, again, it's a never quit attitude that continues on. You could have very well just said, OK, that's it, man. I'm not cut out for this. Obviously, I'm going to go ahead and get kicked out anyway. I might as well go ahead and turn it in and just say I'm done.
Sure.
Yeah. You didn't do that either.
Yep.
You know,
but it's the never quit from the leadership saying that I'm not going to give up on him. I'm going to keep going with him. Right. Yep. He's a good soldier.
That honestly, too, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, you're
it's
good.
Really never an option. Yep. Like quitting, obviously, is, you know, it goes in your head, you know, throughout RAS. Ranger school, you wake up some mornings after 30 minutes of sleep and you're like, dude, why am I here right now? Like, I don't have to be here. But with when you're there at regiment, you're in a training cycle. The option is really never there because your buddies that you PT with every day, you work out at lunch, like you may take a 10, 15 minute lunch, grab something real quick, you get a MyoPlex protein shake, but you're in the gym crushing it with your buddies. That mindset is not there. We are there to train, to take care of each other and to excel at every single level, whether that's a written test that you take or if it's a physical event, to a training cycle, to a deployment. It's never there. It's not on the table.
So Ranger School, you go in between the two deployments, or did you go the second deployment then go to Ranger School?
I went after my second deployment. The second one was in Kandahar. I went to Ranger School. It was actually one of the first classes with females. I went with Jaster, I believe she was a major from the Guard at the time, or Reserves, Haver, and a girl named Grice. One of them were a pilot. It was an interesting experience, especially with the girls being indoctrinated into it. I went straight through to a Florida phase. I recycled Florida. That was an interesting course. For Ranger School, at least in my opinion, it's not hard. It just sucks. Like, it is long hours, heavy weight, moving distances. But once again, like, you know, you do see quitting a lot more there than I would say anywhere else, like compared to like when you're in regiment and stuff like that. You do have people within Ranger School, within your platoon, that as you're going through it together, you identify like, all right, these are group guys, these are dudes from the 75th, tons of West Point grads, stuff like that. And you kind of gravitate towards each other, but you also build camaraderie with these other people to assist each other throughout the course. Ranger School is a wonderful learning experience to see also what can I put my body through and reach a breaking point and then continue moving. There's way harder courses out there. That is just the one that I did. Great course. People call it a leadership course. It is. It's in my opinion, mainly small unit tactics, mm-hmm. the basic battle drills that you conduct. But when you get back to regiment and you have that tab on your shoulder, it is a big deal. Like that is an eye-opening experience, at least for me, going from being a private to getting my tab at regiment. And it's a rite of passage. Like, you get treated better. I didn't have to get on the back of the bus anymore. That was super cool. Has anybody of y'all talked about that before?
No.
I don't know if they do it anymore, man, but like, I remember being a private, like, you were not allowed to get on the front of the bus. You were only allowed to get on the back of the bus, and you had to sit with all of the equipment as well, right? So we load the back of the bus. You have crazy time hacks, right? You get back there, and when you get your tab, it's like, holy crap, I get to walk through the front door of the bus, and I get to sit with, like, maybe one other dude. Like, and maybe one night I'll get to sit by myself, and that was a huge thing. But it's also fun to think back to before you had your tab as a private. You know, those are good times. Like, at the back of the bus, all your buddies, you know, you got, you know, maybe your weapon squad leader or some tabs that are telling you to sing Ranger songs. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. We're driving back from Stewart, 45-minute drive, and we're just getting after it. Like, you know, having a good time. And you made the most out of the bad situations there. But it was fun. It was a good time.
So there's a lot to unpack there. What rank were you then when you went to Ranger School?
I was a specialist.
Okay. I was going to say, usually E4 is about the time frame and everything. Yep. And it is a rite of passage. You have to be, you know, at least, what is it, sergeant? You need to have already had your tab. Mm-hmm. Very few people make it very long inside a regiment without at least having the tab. But you also said that you went through with the first class of women and you called it interesting. Help us understand.
I can only attest to the one person that I was there with. And we weren't necessarily tight. Like the dudes I hung out with within my platoon, I was fortunate enough to go through with another specialist, Andy. I called him Andy Anderson. We were from the same squad at 175.
Oh, wow.
So we were with each other. I went through with another dude named Harada. I think this was like his third or fourth time going through Ranger School from 175. Dude just couldn't stop going. He never got it, but he still wants to go back.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. He's an officer now.
Poor guy.
The biggest eye-opening thing for me, we were in Florida phase, and we had gone straight through, and she had gotten three or four major minuses the last phase, right? So like, you know, like you're recycling, right? We get about 6 RTB, we're outside of the barracks, there's like a big cement pad, we're laying our stuff out, and RI calls her to come to the shack, the RI shack. And we're just like, all right, you know, I'm just happy we're out of the woods, like I'm gonna get to sleep, I get to take care of my stuff. We all knew she didn't get her go. She's in there for like 10 minutes, she comes out, and we're like, what's up? She's like, I passed. And I'm like, red flag, right? Like, first of all, like, at least in my opinion, like, nobody else knew if they got their goes till the following day. We got cleaned up, we're in formation, they came out, they called roster numbers, and you knew if you were a go or not.
Yeah.
She knew the night we got back, because they called her in a cadre shack, for whatever reason, she came out, she had her go. That is really the only thing that I saw. They did have women evaluators walking with our platoons. There were some looks that she had. Looks are just, you know, you get your roster number, you get assigned a position, that she crushed at. She really did. But there were also times that, you know, guys being guys picking up slack for women, it's a thing. Like, at least in my opinion it is. And I know I would do it.
How did she peer out?
I think she did pretty good from her squad. That being said, you know, man, I don't know. That's a dangerous subject.
I'm just, yeah. The thing is, like, if she's still a good teammate, even though maybe she's not, obviously yeah. crushed some stuff, but she didn't crush everything. Yeah. I mean, if she's giving peanut butter packets, a guard shift, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to really put you too much in that tight position there with having to answer that question, but people, there's a lot of stories that go around on the internet. Having an opportunity to talk to somebody that was there, it's, you know, I had to get your perspective of the whole thing.
Sure. And then once again, like about those women, like I view that, but still, those women were beasts of women. Like they may not have necessarily in the other sectors that I didn't view, and I'm sure other Rangers or Ranger students did observe it. They necessarily didn't meet the standard, or maybe they did. But from what I saw, those women, even the one that I saw get that kind of sideways thing happen at the end, they were still badasses. Like those women could get down.
Yeah.
But the one that I observed, there was that thing that happened. And I don't know, you know, the context of whatever happened there. So I think by that time, those girls had been in Ranger School. I graduated class 0915. They had been there since I think they started 0615 or something like that.
That was the thing, too, is that my buddy was talking about is that they had been in Ranger School 2 and 3 times longer than the average class.
Yep. They were there for a long time. So by the time I got there, these like, you know, power to them, like they were still getting after it, but they had been there for a long time.
It was a long period. But
sure.
I'm sure we're going to get plenty of feedback off of this.
It's fine. There's nothing backhanded about it. It's your experience.
Sure.
Yeah.
Nobody can tell you that your experience is wrong.
Sure.
You saw what you saw. You were hungry. You were tired. So were they.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I feel some type of way, too. Like, I'm at every NCOES school across the Army, this conversation is had every time.
Sure.
It's, that guy's on profile, I'm not. Why is the standard different for him on profile and not me?
Yep.
I mean, and that's just across the Army as a whole.
Yep.
So where do we draw the line? Like, where are we drawing the standards line at?
Yep. One of the hardest scenes that and this is kind of outside of active duty into the Guard, which, first of all, I'd like to say the Guard is an amazing program, especially for dudes coming out. They still want to say, like, get their fix, still have that camaraderie. I think it's a wonderful program. One of the hard parts about what I see in the Guard is when dudes hit certain ranks and they get higher up, they turn into these, they preach the right answer, but they don't maintain the standards. So you may have an E7 that's 275 pounds, fat body, that is beaten up E4s, E1s, that can't pass a PT test, when this dude can't even walk up the stairs. Yeah. Like, it's...
But his excuse is, when I was an E4, I got 300s.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Back then, I could do it. So why can't you do it now?
That's right.
And my experiences limit me from, or disqualify me from, having to meet that standard because I have this experience.
Yeah.
That's like saying I'm not going to fill sandbags because I filled sandbags last deployment.
Well, yeah. I see that on an active duty. I mean, you know, with social media now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, with social media out there now, you can, there's a lot of pictures that get out, which there weren't in the past and stuff. And sure, you know, my supply sergeant or weapons armor or whatever was always, I remember, was always the heavier person or the admin or whatever type of thing. And but then they started getting the weight standards and making them tougher and everything else for people. And then it looks like now, like you're talking about, what you're experiencing in the Guard, I think we're seeing on active duty. I'm seeing general officers.
See people that are selected for the Sergeant Major's Academy that...
I haven't seen that. But I mean,
That being said, though, like, once again, the Guard's a great program. I think it's awesome. They do wonderful things. And I honestly think they get not as much credit as they deserve. Like, a lot, especially now, like, you know, we have active duty units. And this, once again, is just my opinion. You know, we have active duty units, these guys who, because they're active duty, they think that they kind of have, like, a leg up. Well, a lot of these active duty units, they're not deploying anymore. These National Guard units, like, for instance, during COVID, right? These guys got activated for a year, then went straight into the peaceful protests that were going on, and they're constantly on rotation. So, for an example, the Guard right now in the state of Georgia, man, they're in, like, Egypt, Kosovo, all over the world. And I don't think people really recognize that these dudes not only are doing that, but they're maintaining a civilian job and also providing for a family, and they do wonderful things. But back to the standard thing, you know, it's seen personally at every level, not at the 75th. That place is it is a machine, and it provides quality human beings at every aspect.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very interesting, man.
That's our last time at Fort Moore. Was kind of an eye opener. Mm-hmm. It didn't look like it back in the day when there was other force com units on post.
Sure.
Meaning the grass was high. Yeah, it looks pretty run down.
Yeah,
like raggedy. And
what we didn't expect was kind of everywhere to look like that. I can understand like if some places, but it was. So I think the area beautification, and maybe this spills over into 670-1, that kind of thing, has been just so... I wonder if we're experiencing like a post-Vietnam type army at this point. You know what I mean? Like that comparison, I don't think that comparison is too far off when it comes to old Army standards that you think of as Army standards.
So let's go back to our original conversation about that topic where I was describing what a member of the 75th Ranger Regiment or one of the battalions look like. And then what I experienced when I walked back into a PX and stuff, having been away from an installation for a couple years. And then now seeing the GWAT Ranger guys. And so very, very different. Because the priorities and, again, the things that were most important at that time frame weren't necessarily applied. I mean, the uniforms changed. They went to brown boots. They went to uniforms you can wash and wear. You went to So it was designed to be more of that. And so it's a question that I've asked several guests is, how challenging is it now to get back into the disciplinary aspects of things when you let that go for so long?
Sure.
And it wasn't important. What was most important was how we're going to train to fight for the next deployment and what we're going to do in that mission. And many of them say it's a bit of a challenge, but those like, you know, the Regimental Sergeant Major, Brad Johnson, you know, he's experienced both sides of it.
Sure.
He experienced pre-war and what it was like to be a Ranger at that time frame and in as well conventional Army soldier to now having to experience that again in his rank and position to try to instill that discipline that once was there previously, but we kind of let, I wouldn't say regiment let it go, but at least the conventional Army, I think there was different priorities at that time frame. You didn't spend as much time on those types of things. So I think you're right. I think there's probably a little bit of that transitional period that's going on at the moment.
It'll take, you know, a decade or longer to kind of get back where, from a visual standpoint, you would think of.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, it is interesting. You know, at least when I, and I can only speak to the time I was there. When I was there, we would try to push the limits on certain things. Like, everybody wants to look cool. There's that joke, what's the number one rule, right? But, transitioning out, and like, I didn't get to serve with the 75th outside of a wartime. But I do the guard now, and I'm on Fort Moore. I'm only there seldomly, but you can definitely tell the difference, I guess, within soldiers that are walking around on that post. Especially when you're coming from, say, like Hunter Army Airfield, we've got, we got 160th, 175, and I think we've got some 3rd ID folks. So the dudes that walk around there are pretty, pretty sharp, squared away. And I've never really experienced, say, a big installation. And at Fort Moore, you could go from seeing, a dude from 375 walking around that, super sharp monster, and then you go to the PX and you see some dudes, like some brand new lieutenant that's ate up, long hair. You got dudes that have got beards and soft shoe profiles, and it's just weird, man. Like, but I'm sure it will come around swing. I do think it's very important, that level of professionalism. Appearance is a huge thing. I mess with my, I don't, it's probably a bad thing to say. I always tell my kids, it's like, if people tell you it doesn't matter how you look, I don't think they're being honest with you. I think the way you look and the way you present yourself professionally is a huge deal. And I think the 75th really hits on that good. Yeah. Maintaining that standard, the way you present yourself, not only in a work environment, in a civilian environment as well, just simply from, you get your safety briefs on a weekend, don't be an idiot, right? However, when you go out, it's expected that you represent the organization in a professional manner at all times. You're not a dumbass when you're out there. And if you are a dumbass when you go out there, guess what's going to happen?
Yeah.
You're out. Very, very cool place to be at.
How long did you end up staying total active duty?
I only did my first enlistment.
Okay.
And then I went straight from my first enlistment to the guard. And I think I'm about to hit 13, 14 years now.
So let's talk about the transition then. When you came off active duty, I'm sure you kind of thought you had a plan. How did that go?
So I talked to my wife about this, man. So getting out of the 75th was honestly probably one of the hardest life decisions I had ever made. And I honestly got teared up in the cough. And it was super embarrassing because I was sitting there talking to Slater. Slater, he's my squad leader at the time. Wonderful man. Probably the most aggressive human being I've ever been around. He gave me shit up until the end. Like, I had already, like, finished my paperwork, everything like that, and I was still outside at the Connexes helping load shit up. I just couldn't give it up. And he kind of, like, he would always mess with me. He's like, you're quitting, man. Like, why are you quitting? And very difficult decision. Ultimately, like, it worked out very well. I've been very fortunate in my life. Transitioning out was definitely difficult. You go from an environment of, once again, these monsters and beasts of men that are professional at every single level, whether it's administratively to being, doing PT to even like down to what you eat, to going to a civilian world where you're not surrounded by that anymore. And I think the hard thing is you're finding a sense of purpose in life when you leave, and you don't have anybody there next to you. And nobody necessarily can understand what you're going through. Easiest thing for me, man, is like transition out. Fortunately, I had a good place to go. But you would be sitting there during the day, where at the 75th, you're always looking for work, whether it's you're at the cough or you're in a shoot house. If you're not working, you're not doing the right thing. The civilian world, you could be sitting around and be like, what am I doing right now? Like, what is the next thing to do? And there may not be anything. And then you start, kind of questioning yourself, looking for that brother to turn to. And it can definitely be difficult. It can be. I was fortunate enough that my family had started a business over 30 years ago, and I fell right into it. And we have expanded so much since I've been out. And the biggest thing for me, too, when I got out, and for dudes that are getting out, is to maintain contact with your friends. Stay in touch. Call them, text them. I got buddies now. My buddy Schaefer, we were team leaders together, and we may not stay in touch as much, but we still, pick at each other. Every week we'll get a text like, hey man, you forgot about me. Or like, yesterday I was messaging him because I saw pictures of his daughter playing volleyball, or his son's playing hockey. It's really important at least for me, when I transitioned, was to stay in touch with people with the same type of mindset who are going through similar things so that we can be there for each other. Not that I've ever gotten to that level. However, there are folks out there that do get to that level that struggle. And me personally, it's just finding that sense of purpose in your daily life.
Yeah, I think that last part is the key.
I
mean, I think a lot of guys, you know, think they have a plan, and they probably do. They may have a great plan, but then when they come out, it's more challenging to execute it because it is very different. Going from that very regimented type of lifestyle, I mean, we know when to get up, we know where we've got to be, we get three meals a day, you know, those types of things, to all of a sudden you got to think a little bit more about the other aspects of your life and families, if you're married and such, certainly makes it different. And you having a family business helped with that transition, but you said you went into the Guard as well. Was that something that you chose as a contract coming straight off active duty? So you knew you were going into it, or?
So it, like I mentioned, that was the hardest decision I've ever made, was leaving. And the Guard was kind of, in my mind, number one, like, the benefits are awesome, right? Like, everybody loves the benefits. So that's a plus. But the thing for me was easing my way out and kind of one foot in the door, right? And I'm still doing it. I tell my wife it's the way I get my fix. Like, I look forward to the times that I get to go there. And even though it's not the same, so there are some dudes there. I still, fortunately, the unit I'm at, we've got guys from 175. We've got guys from all over. But it's a way to stay in and still have that semi camaraderie. So you do have that purpose. But I use it as a way to transition. And it's really, really been beneficial. Definitely recommend it for dudes.
You end up going right into SFAB?
No. So I went first into the 48th Bravo Company. And dude, well, I tell you, it was an eye opener. Like, you go from like 175 at the COF to now I'm at drill in what looks like a gymnasium. And, you know, bringing that mentality into the Guard, it can be very intimidating for other people because they're not used to that same level of training, you know.
Just the intensity of it.
The intensity, exactly. Like, I remember my first day there, there was this kid late for formation, brand new guy. Dude, I laid into him, and that's just not the way it is. Like, it is not that environment. That all being said, though, like, they've never been brought up that way. These dudes could be, you know, a McDonald's employee. Then the next day they've got on a uniform and they're expected to perform at a certain standard. And right on, man, that's super cool. But coming out of the 75th into the Guard, it's a hard environment to adapt to. So I started at the 48th. I went to the 121st with Seco. And that was my first really enjoyable moment in the Guard. There's this guy named Mike Pence. He's an old 375 guy. He was my first sergeant. Coolest dude ever. He works for, I think he works for Under Armour. That guy is a guy who is super professional, very mellow, soft-spoken, but he knows his stuff. Wonderful dude to be around. And that unit was filled with a ton of prior active duty guys, and we got along great, whether it was Marine Corps guys, 75th dudes, whatever it was an awesome environment, and it really opened my eyes to the organization and like the type of place that I can embed myself and also grow professionally on that side, as well as my civilian life as well. And then I went from there down to SFAB, and SFAB's pretty cool. It's a it's a cool environment. The level of individuals they bring into the organization is higher, which I really love. I'm serving with one of my good friends, Mike Lewis. We were in the same company at 175 together. We literally swapped. So I showed up and he had left. But I had heard about him, and awesome dude. He's deployed right now with the Guard. My first sergeant, Neil Andreessen, amazing dude. So I've been very, very fortunate within my Guard experience that it's been so impactful for my life, as well as benefiting me on the civilian side as well. Because you also, you know, you may meet a dude who's an E5, but on the outside, he may be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, and that's another cool thing too, right? So you may have a private over here, E1, and your truck breaks down. He's an infantry dude, but a civilian side, he works on trucks. So he'd get after it and fix your truck. Or this E2 may be a nurse and he can assist the medic doing this. So not only do you have a, like, they're qualified MOS, but you have a civilian professional.
They're cross-trained.
They're cross-trained that can help you out on other levels. So it's a very cool environment.
So you said SFAB, for those who listening or watching who don't are not familiar with that acronym, mm-hmm. tell us what that is.
So we're a Security Forces Advisement Brigade, I believe is what it is. And I apologize to listeners if I butchered that.
Yeah.
I'm still relatively new to it. What I essentially do is I help out with the indoctrination process, right? So dudes show up, we have new guys, and there's standards, which is really cool. And our sergeant majors now, if you don't want to be there, you don't have to be there. They will send you back. However, if you are there, you are expected to perform at a standard that is acceptable to the unit. So my job is, and teaching classes, whether that's marksmanship classes, land navigation, we do RUCs, we do PT, and throughout it, we evaluate the individual and see if they're a right fit to come into the organization. The SFAB unit in the Guard, they're squared away, and I think it's going the right direction, especially for dudes that are in the Guard that say maybe don't want to go SF and the National Guard, but they want a higher level of professionalism and essentially better folks to be around while they're spending that time there.
Yeah. So in the very beginning, we'll talk about this probably at some point with a couple of sergeant majors that live locally that we were talking about that were in SFAB. But in the very beginning, it wasn't received very well within the Army, like a lot of things, and primarily because the officer who decided to do this chose a beret initially that was too close to certain colors, and there were some changes that were made, and then just so many factors, taking away the mission from Special Forces that was already done in terms of an advisory capacity and times. And so at least it sounds like it's moving forward, and like everything, like we were talking about earlier, it evolves. The Army starts getting it right. They have to work out the kinks. There has to be individuals like yourself to join in different capacities that help it mature as it begins to go along through its journey. Mm-hmm. And sounds like the Guard's gone through much of the same thing then.
Sure.
Do you guys do a lot of interface with the active duty SFAB units?
Not so much. Yeah. They're kind of like your neighbors next door that you don't talk to. Mm-hmm. So there is that kind of weird tension, like Rangers and SEALs, like there's that thing. It's the same thing with Guard guys and active duty guys, right? So there's like the active duty guys talk down to the Guard guys. The Guard guys talk shit about the active duty guys because they're active duty and they look like shit. So it's a friendly camaraderie and intensity between the units. It's nothing bad. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you spent, are you guys airborne or anything too? Is it?
There was a airborne unit in the Guard. It was a LERSH unit.
Yeah.
And initially when I had gotten
here
out.
Here in Georgia, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
I had tried to go to it. One of my good friends, Mike Fout, he was at 175 with me. And he told me, like, hey, man, come over here. It's just like it's very close to the 75th. We have standards. And the second I put in for I don't know the exact terminology, essentially a transfer, the unit disbanded. I believe there still is a airborne unit, but they are I think it's a non-combat unit.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I do remember that. There used to be a lot of LARP and LERS units that were out within the National Guard uh-huh. that as I was helping from an in-service, help individuals take a look at opportunities inside, outside, whatever, those Guard opportunities attracted a lot of the former Ranger guys. Mm-hmm. If they didn't want to go Green Beret or SF or anything and didn't want an 18 slot, then they'd end up taking one of those.
Sure.
At least that way they could maintain a certain level and get a chance to jump, mm-hmm. and those types of things. So that's unfortunate that the Georgia Guard decided to mm-hmm. do away with that. And for those who are not familiar with the Guard, too, you're state-operated, and so the governor of the state really is the one that's the commander-in-chief,
yep.
Yet you could be also federalized.
Yep.
So you have kind of both those aspects, whereas the reserve is federal.
Yep, and that we got the whole January 6th thing, we got called up for that, state-wise, they get called up all the time, whether it's, they assisted with the border. They had dudes out there for such a long time. And once again, COVID, the peaceful protesting, stuff like that. So they do really, I honestly, truly believe they don't get a lot of credit for what they really deserve. I mean, these dudes are always working. They're always doing something. So
the Warrior Training Center, I don't know if you're familiar with them.
WTC.
Yeah, WTC down at Fort Moore. We've done some episodes with them as well, and especially talked about their programs that they have where they take individuals straight from OSIT and then they go right into pre-ranger, ranger school, and then they send them to airborne. Maybe if they have time, send them to air assault. By the time they come up, I mean, they've got everything, you know, they're as a PV2. And have you experienced those guys yet?
So my buddy Mike Lewis, the dude from 175, he worked at WTC as a pre-ranger instructor. The only knowledge I have is what I've heard from Mike and what I've observed from the outside looking in. They seem like a very professional organization, very, very professional, standard bearers. And the quality of soldiers that are in that place that train other soldiers is very good.
Yeah. I didn't know if you had experienced it on the other side from the guard of receiving those individuals privates. Okay. I know that the commander at the maneuver center is now, I don't know whether it was by listening to this podcast or whatever it was, but has caught wind of what they're doing and how that program works. And one of the things that we suggested is, why don't they do this for all active duty enlisted soldiers? Because when you think about it, that's the officer pattern. You know, you either have a tab or you have a story if you're an infantry officer. And so in the case of enlisted, why don't we put them through a similar type of program and imagine what kind of force that we could have by the time, especially they become an NCO.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so I think they're starting to evaluate those types of opportunities. And
I think it makes better sense from an athletic standpoint, too. 18-year-old kid moves a lot better than a 25-year-old staff sergeant with three.
Yeah, but you also have those 18-year-olds that don't want to get after it.
Well, that's a great weed out process.
I was just getting ready to say that some of the people who said that they had a better experience were those who were older that went to Ranger School because they actually had got through that whole maturity phase, immaturity phase, and were actually willing to pay attention, stay focused.
If you could just catch them on their first enlistment or something. Yeah. Like that, something where they're not
like an E4 or something. Yeah. If you could run them through that type of program, you know, where there's, in other words, it's like regiment, you know, when you reach this certain rank, there's an expectation.
Sure.
You know, you can, here's the path that you can choose, but we have a route by which you can go to a pre-ranger, go to ranger, go to airborne, go to air assault, whatever that may be in that type of package. I think there's some benefits to that, you know, for certain. So, you know, as you've had the opportunity then from being on one end of receiving good NCO coaching, mentoring, and those types of things to now being one. What's your rank now?
I'm 86 now.
Okay. Yep. So now you get the opportunity to pay it forward. Mm-hmm. How much fun is that?
It's a good time. So when I first got out and, you know, coming into the guard, I was semi like a fire breather because you're expected, you know, within the regiment to be at a certain level. And what I've really had to do is tone it down. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to, essentially the way that I conversate with individuals in the guard now is the same way I do it professionally in the civilian world is, you know, you got to get on their same level. Yeah. These dudes have got, you know, problems at home. They may have financial problems, things like that. And they may not be receptive to you getting after them by yelling at them and telling them that, you know, you're not meeting the standard, you know, do some push-ups, whatever, burpees, whatever it is. So I think the best way for me and, you know, dudes that I work with is we treat them like humans, you know, as good people. And we approach it in an educational way, you know, teach them, you know, how to do it, but we also show them how to do it and how to execute it the right way. And we're not destroying them at every corner, you know, whereas, you know, when I was a tab, you know, man, like I felt like my job was like, you know, I got to keep these privates in line while also maintaining doing my job. And I may have been looking all the time, you know, like, they clean in the coffee in the afternoon, like, oh, they missed the sink, you know, yelling at everybody, you know, whereas now it's, you know, a little bit different.
Yeah.
But it's really cool though, because once again, the 75th, it set me up for success in the civilian world. But the civilian world itself, once, you know, you find your purpose, you find the appropriate people to be around. And that's a big one too, is the appropriate people to be around. You don't want to, you know, get in with the folks that are doing dumb crap when you get out. Has really benefited me personally to be able to deal with individuals within the guard that say may not come from, you know, the same background that I come from, that, you know, may come from an area within Georgia that's very low income or have a rough life and they're barely getting by. It's been super beneficial.
Well, they say surround yourself with five that, you know, closest people that are going to challenge you but also make the most impact on your decisions in life and everything. And that sounds, you know, when you think back on it, from the 75th Ranger Regiment, your time served there. It sounds like the foundation that that laid of doing the very same thing, because if you did mess up, mm-hmm. you're being RFS.
Sure.
So, you know, you don't want to get released. And that stays in your mind that you have to earn what you're doing every day. And that foundational piece is something you're giving advice when an individual transitions. Don't forget those opportunities as well when you get out here on the outside. Continue to surround yourself with the right people and doing the right things. Yeah,
that's right. A lot of dudes that I've seen, and even currently with veterans within this community, they may turn to alcohol for help to deal with things, turn to drugs, stuff like that. And they may even be surrounded by other veterans who are pushing it on them. This is just me speaking and, you know, on that subject. I think more of a beneficial thing, especially within our community here, is not turning towards alcohol, but supporting each other with a better future, not turning like, hey man, let's go drink some beers and talk about the old times. Like, no man, I have a job opportunity for you. Let me support you. Let me support your family, and let's get moving and let's get after it in life. You know?
Yeah. There's a difference in reminiscing and being stuck. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, being reminiscent of something is, you know, gleaning the lesson from it. Right. But being stuck is just reliving the event in your head over and over and over.
Yeah.
So that makes tons of sense. I'm glad you said that, because a lot of our listeners are guys who may be, you know, maybe stuck a little bit.
Sure.
And that's okay. Yeah. But it's okay to be reminiscent and still be moving forward. You can still remember those people, remember those times.
Sure.
But where's the lesson? And how are you pushing forward?
Yeah. And with the hardest thing I have right now on my civilian side is finding people that are qualified folks to do work. And I'm not trying to do a plug here. I would love to have veterans come to me that are having a hard time and that I could give a job to and allow them to grow within the company for them and their families to be successful. It is just, it's hard right now finding folks that want to get out there and get after it, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, you're talking about the type of DNA makeup that these individuals, you know, they're going to do their best and work hard. I think the biggest part of that transition, even going back to that, is taking that leap of faith and getting out there and having confidence and a drive and a passion to want to do something. But it also takes somebody willing to open the door and let them get their foot inside.
Sure. And there are tons of people within our community that are willing to do that for them. But there's also the folks in the community that are willing to, you know, sit down, have drinks, get drunk, and reminisce on the good times that were back then. Mm-hmm. And that can always lead to, you know, a negative future, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So,
Man, I appreciate you coming on the show, Ethan, and sharing your journey and words of wisdom and everything that you've dropped here today. What's next for you as you go down the line, especially within the Army or the National Guard? Is it still staying within the SFAB? Are you looking at putting 20 in?
I may, you know, honestly, man. Yeah, close. My wife wants me to do it. it's up in the air, honestly, man. My biggest focus right now is work. You know, work, supporting the people that work for me and their families.
Yeah.
And just, you know, the community as well. So, but I appreciate you guys having me, man. This has been a blessing. You guys are awesome.
Well, I appreciate it.
Thank you all very much.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah.